All right, on the air.
Wednesday morning Bible study, Revelation. We are going to do chapter 6 today. And it's a total of, I think, 17 verses. So that's right in our wheelhouse. That's about, you know, I expect to do about 15 verses in an hour and a half class. So we should be able to squeak it out just in time. And we have to do that today, by the way, because I have to leave for the soup kitchen. I'm taking some kids to the soup kitchen. So I can't run too much over today. All right, so let me reset just a couple of minutes, a recap of where we've been. We just finished chapters 4 and 5, which you remember is the great vision of heaven, of Jesus' ascension and his coronation in heaven from the viewpoint of heaven. In Luke and Acts, we can see that ascension of Jesus from the standpoint of the disciples on earth watching Jesus go. And then in Revelation 4 and 5, we see Jesus arriving into heaven and being crowned as victor and king. And that's a great comfort to us. We keep that vision, that mental image in mind as we go forward, beginning these visions that John now has of Judgment Day. 7 visions of Judgment Day. Just a little bit of a side note to kind of inform you, to educate you a little bit on some of the differences in interpretation. When looking at these upcoming 7 visions, and looking at the writers of the Lutheran Study Bible, a bunch of our Lutheran scholars, a bunch of them are seminary professors, they are the ones that, and I don't know which one, I didn't look up to see which ones wrote the study notes for the book of Revelation in the Lutheran Study Bible, but they are the ones that, in the outline, way back on week one, you remember, said there these are 7 different visions of Judgment Day that are coming up next, starting now in chapter 6. That's the outline that I'm kind of following. I agree with that. And Dr. Brighton, in this other commentary that I'm reading, says there are only 3 visions. Well, wait a second. How could that be? Aren't we all Lutherans? Why don't they agree with each other? 2 different, you know, scholars, and here and there, they're talking about 2 different things. Well, I want to just take a couple of minutes and kind of point out to you, and this is some of the difference in interpretation, and they're actually kind of saying the same thing. But just, it's a little, not only is it educational for us, in case, you know, this topic were ever to come up or, you know, a comment, but also it helps us to understand how easily Revelation can be interpreted in different ways, and that's, it's dangerous for that reason. So first I want to say, put up on the screen the outline. This is all the way back from week one. This is the outline of the whole book of Revelation that we went over back in week one, and this is from the Lutheran Study Bible. So, see, right here, we finish the heavenly sanctuary, the divine throne, chapters 4 and 5. And then in the Lutheran Study Bible, there's the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th scene of the end times. There's the chapters that relate to them. The first scene goes from chapter 6 through the beginning verses of chapter 8. So we're going to go through chapter 6 today. Well, Dr. Brighton counts this differently. And the first scene of the end times and the second scene of the end times, he also agrees with these. Those are 2 scenes of Judgment Day coming up. We're going to deal with those in shorter, coming up right here in these next couple of weeks. But then the third scene, Dr. Brighton doesn't count as one of the visions of Judgment Day. He says it's an interlude. It's an intermission. And the reason he says that is if you look at these verses, it's chapters 12 through 14, this third vision, it starts by recounting the fall of Satan out of heaven. Well, that's not part of Judgment Day. That's going actually all the way back to creation. The time right after creation, God created in 6 days, the 7th day he rested, and sometime between that 7th day and when we pick up the account of Adam and Eve being tempted by Satan, we don't know how long that span is in there, okay, that time frame. You know, it would be a matter of days, weeks, or months. It's not a matter of eons, like some evolutionists would say. It's not that. But it's a matter of some days, weeks, or months. Sometime in there, Satan rebelled against God and was kicked out of heaven. And we get a glimpse of that here in the beginning of chapter 12, this third scene. However, this vision ends, 14, in chapter 14, with a view of Judgment Day. Okay, so it spans a greater time length. These other visions span Judgment Day in a more narrow sense. If you think of Judgment Day, I mean, it's not necessarily a 24-hour day, but there's kind of a beginning of Judgment Day when Judgment Day is beginning, and then there's the turmoil of Satan as he's fighting back, and then there's the final
gaveled, you know, condemnation, the judgment of Satan and the casting of him into hell, that's all part of Judgment Day. So these other visions are that that view of that mini timeline of Judgment Day itself. This third scene is broader. It starts a whole way back with why Judgment Day has to happen, because Satan rebelled against God way back here at creation and was kicked out of heaven. So the Lutheran Study Bible scholars say, well, that is still a scene of the end times, battle between the triune God and the anti-trinity. But Dr. Bright says, well, no, that's kind of an interlude. It's not the same as these. But you see, it sort of is the same. I kind of agree with the outline of the Lutheran Study Bible here. The fourth scene of the end times is the pouring out of the seven bowls of wrath. The fourth scene, Dr. Bright says that's the third scene, because he doesn't count this as one of the scenes of Judgment Day. And then the fifth, sixth, and seventh scenes are all scenes that are more narrowly focused on the actual pronouncement of judgment upon Satan and the victory thereafter. So if, you know, Judgment Day spans this much time, those final three scenes are just focused on the very end of Judgment Day rather than the whole day of Judgment Day. Does that make sense? So the reason I say that is because, you know, even amongst our Lutheran scholars, Revelation can be a little bit confusing as to how to interpret it. I align myself, I like the outline of the Lutheran Study Bible, which is the one we went over in week one, and which is right here. Seven scenes, they all have something to do with Judgment Day, with end times, in one way or another. They may not be exactly parallel, because they're some of, like that third one begins all the way back at creation, but they all have something to do with that, okay?
Does that say then that the beginning of time was when?
Beginning of time, I would say, is when God began to create on day one. Okay, so, all right, yes?
Does the devil know what's ahead for him? Does the devil know what?
What's ahead for him? Does the devil know what's ahead for him? What's coming up?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I would think he does. The scriptures, here, Revelation, he can look over somebody's shoulder and see what was written. So he's aware of at least Revelation. He knows that his condemnation is coming. Exactly what that means for him, maybe he doesn't understand the nuances of it or the exact nature of the outcome. But I think he understands he's been defeated by Christ and that his final judgment is coming. So I don't have a precise answer for you, other than I think he at least has a hint in some sense of what's coming, but he may not know the full completeness of it.
The devil is so full of himself, he wouldn't realize it.
Well, that may be. Yeah, he is very full of himself, focused on himself. That's kind of the nature of sin, right? For all of us as well, focusing on ourselves rather than on others or on God. Yeah, that's true. Okay. Yeah, Mary, you look like you're itching to ask a question.
Well, I mean, this is not scripture, of course, but in the Screwtape Letters, what gets the impression from what the devil is saying that he knows he's going to be defeated, and he knows that there are some people that he's never going to get, but he wants to take as many people as he possibly can down with him.
Right. Well, and that's from the mind of C.S. Lewis.
Right.
He was pretty educated and theologically sound, generally. I kind of agree with that view of the devil, that he knows he's going to be defeated, but he's still struggling, he's still rebellious, he still wants to corrupt as many people as he can. Yeah. All right, so let's begin. Let me close this right here up. Revelation chapter 6. Okay, there we go. There's the first half of the chapter. This is verses 1 through 8. If I can get a volunteer, yeah. You want to go, Len?
Sure.
All right.
Now I watched when the Lamb opened one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures say with a voice like thunder, "Come." And I looked, and behold, a white horse. And its rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come." and out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth, so that people should slay one another, and he was given a great sword. When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come," and I looked, and behold, a black horse. Its rider had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and wine." And he opened the fourth seal, and I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, "Come." And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed him. And they were given authority over a fourth of the earth, to kill with sword and famine and pestilence and by wild beasts of the earth.
All right, thank you. Now, the first thing I want to point out here, before we get into this text specifically, is that in apocalyptic literature, when you see images of things that appear kind of normal to us, things that we could encounter on earth, like here's there's horsemen, and the horses are different colors, they're colors that we would see, and the horsemen are carrying objects which we could encounter here in this earthly life. When you see images like this that are normal, that's a depiction in apocalyptic literature of judgment or events which we also could normally encounter. Okay, and you'll see what I mean as soon as we start explaining this. On the other hand, when you see images that are clearly fanciful to us, like coming up a little bit later, there's going to be locusts with faces on them. Or the living creatures, which are the cherubim, and they have the face of a lion or the face of an ox. I mean, there's not something you would encounter on this earth. That then represents to or aligns to some supernatural event, which would be not normal in our everyday existence. Okay? So I'm only pointing that out to kind of set the groundwork for this. Because as we see in these first four images, normal creatures and normal objects. So these are going to align themselves or point to normal occurrences in our life and our existence. All right? So that being said, let me get into it, and you'll see immediately what I'm talking about. First of all, I watched the Lamb open one of the seven seals. So to reset just a little bit, remember at the end of the vision in chapter 5, John is kind of weeping. Who will open the book of life? Who will open the scroll? And no one is worthy. And then there comes the Lamb. There's the coronation of Jesus, and he takes the scroll, but he doesn't start opening the seals yet. Here he starts to open the seals. So this links this to the previous vision. He begins to open the seven seals. We see he opens the first four seals right here in rapid succession. Boom, 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 boom. The first four seals. And in all four of them, notice there's a similarity here. When he opens the seals, one of the four living creatures, I think there might be a relationship there, one of the four living creatures says with a voice, "Come." The living creatures, remember what the living creatures are? Cherubim, right? The honor guard around God. And they're pointing John to these details. Hey, look, the Lamb is opening a scroll, one of the seals. Look what's happening. You see what's happening? So the four living creatures are kind of directing the attention of John. That's what's going on. You see it here four times, right there in verse 1. Then here again in verse 3, when he opened the second seal, the second creature said, "Come, come, take a look, see what's going on here." There in verse 5 is the third seal, the living creature. And there in verse 7, the fourth seal, the fourth living creature says, "Come." So that's repeated over and over. So just so you see that continuity there. Then he opens the first seal, and what does John see? A white horse, and its rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer. First question, who is that?
Jesus.
That is a very common thought, even among some Lutherans. Well, that's Jesus. And that, there's some reason to think that. It's a white horse, he's wearing a crown, he's conquering. Jesus would kind of fit that description. And later on in Revelation, Jesus does appear on a white horse. So there's some, okay, this must be Jesus. However, there's a little problem with that. Jesus is the one opening the seals. So how could that be Jesus? Plus, as we look at this, when you see what these four horses represent, you will realize that horse does not represent Jesus. And that is to say, what does this white horse with its rider and bow and a crown represent? I want to read for you just a short paragraph from from the commentary, which will help direct our attention. Let me find it here. All right, this is what Dr. Brighton says. The first horse is white. Its rider has a battle bow and wears a crown. He comes forth for the purpose of conquering. He exists solely to conquer and be victorious in his effort. The bow is the symbol of intention to conquer by military might and prowess. The only mounted archers in the ancient world were the Parthians, who were so fierce that Rome could never completely subject them. The Parthian military leaders also were said to ride white horses into battle. The crown that the rider of the white horse wears proclaims that in his conquering role, he will be victorious. So, a little bit of a cultural context here. You don't necessarily need this to understand this, but it does help. The Parthians at that time were the only known mounted archers, and they rode white horses, and they were fierce. The Romans themselves couldn't completely conquer them and subject them. The Parthians were like in modern-day Iran, okay, or Persia. And so they were on the edge of the Roman Empire, and Rome couldn't conquer them. So this represents, even if you don't understand that little cultural tidbit, even if you don't understand that, you can look at this and say, well, this is clearly some sort of warrior wearing a crown and a bow, and he's conquering. This represents war. Okay? What we just saw, what I just read. War, tyranny, oppression, conquering. That's what this represents. So, when the Lamb opens the first seal, the beginning of judgment will be the onset of war. Okay? You're going to see all four of these horsemen relate. It'll make sense. They all are related to each other. And doesn't Jesus say the same thing? Jesus says much the same thing. The end will come. You will see wars and rumors of wars. Right? Here's war coming on. That's what this represents. A white horse is a horse of victory. He's wearing a crown. He's there for the purpose of conquering. Okay? Does that make sense? It'll make even more sense as we go along.
Yeah.
The second seal. He opens the second seal, the second living creature. Hey, look at this, John. Here it comes. And out comes another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth, so that people should slay one another, and he was given a great sword. What is the opposite of peace? He takes peace from the earth.
War.
The opposite of peace is war, but even more so than war, I mean, even if people are warring, an aspect of war that's related to a sword, the horse is bright red, bloodshed and violence. What's the result of war? Bloodshed and violence. See, these are related. And that's the opposite of peace, is violence, turmoil, chaos. Does war bring chaos and turmoil?
Yes.
Does war bring violence and bloodshed?
Yes.
Absolutely. The horse is red. The rider is carrying a sword. And he's taking away peace from among the earth. That's related to the first horse. See, the first horse comes and brings war. The second horse comes and brings violence and bloodshed. Okay? All right, see how these are normal creatures to us, and they're bringing about the beginning of Judgment Day. They're bringing about the beginning of Judgment Day, and these are normal events that we would experience. Okay. Third seal. I heard the third living creature say, come. Hey, look, John, here it is. I looked, and behold, a black horse. And its rider had a pair of scales in his hand. Now, when you think, let me finish this. I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures sing, a quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and wine. Now, this one's a little bit more confusing. You know, I mentioned this one is war. That seems a little, it kind of makes sense. White horse, bow and arrow, crown, he's wearing crown, he's conquering. Okay, that's war. This one, yeah, the bright red and the sword and taking peace. Yeah, that's violence and bloodshed. I get that. What in the world does this third horse have to do? Well, let's begin with scales. When you think of scales, what do you think of?
Justice.
Yeah, justice, right. You know, when I said that last night, two people said, fish.
Yeah.
I had to laugh. We laughed. I said, fish, yeah. When I think of scales, you think of that image, you know, in our courtroom of the lady with the blindfold on holding up the scales for justice. Right. That's not what it meant back then.
Commerce?
Yeah. What was the scale originally used for? Why is the scale in that image of justice in our modern-day culture? Because the scale was the implement of commerce, of the economy, of the marketplace. Everything you traded and bought and sold had to be weighed so it could be properly priced. And it was a big deal, we hear in the Old Testament, some of the prophets, and Jesus as well, if you cheated on your scales. You know, you put your thumb on there, or you shave off some shavings off your weights. You'd have standardized weights, and so, okay, this is a 1 pound weight, it wouldn't be 1 pound, but, you know, whatever their weight measures are, 1 kilogram, no, they didn't have that either. You'd have your weights on there, and you could weigh out your produce. Okay, that's worth this much. So what's going on here? The black horse, its rider had a pair of scales in his hands, the implement of commerce, of the economy, and he heard a voice saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius. See, this has to do with commerce, with trade, the marketplace. Yeah, Don?
Is that inflation?
That is inflation. This is an ungodly expensive price for wheat. A denarius is 1 day's wage. That's true throughout the time of the Bible. In Jesus' time, there really wasn't that much inflation over the century that Jesus lived within. Well, a denarius had been and continued to be 1 day's wage. Okay? Now, let's put that in today's terms. If you work 8 hours and you work at the minimum wage today is $8 and something, right? So I'll call it 60-something dollars. But if you work just a little bit above the minimum wage, say $10 or $12, and you work 10 hours, you're going to make maybe, say, $100. Just as a discussion point, $100. Let's say that's what the modern-day equivalent of a denarius would be a $100 bill. You work a day's wage, here's a $100 bill. And you're buying a quart of wheat for that. Now, these are wheat berries.
Would this be the same as our quart?
Yes, actually. The word here in the Greek is not quart. It's actually it's a different word, but the translators say that that word for that measure in the Bible times is just a smidgen less than our modern-day quart.
Okay.
So this is not an accurate word here, but it is an appropriate translation for the volume indicated. Okay? So think of it that way. So you got a quart jar. You all know what a quart jar is. I know we just finished canning tomatoes and applesauce, so we got a lot of quart jars around. Quart jar full of wheat berries. How much flour would that make? I had no clue, so I looked it up. I actually Googled, like, how much flour from 1 quart of wheat. And it came up with, depending on how fine you grind it and what the quality is and all, and how tightly packed and all that, 3 to 4 cups of flour. How much bread can you make from 3 to 4 cups of flour? That's one loaf, right?
Yeah.
I know in my, what's that?
A skinny loaf.
A skinny loaf? Okay. Yeah, I know in my homemade bread maker machine where you pour in all the ingredients and you push the button, it's kind of handy, really. It makes a three cup loaf of bread, which is just, you know, it's like this. Not super size, I mean, kind of normal size bread, 3 cups of flour. So, you're paying, I mean, to put this in modern day terms, you're paying $100 for one loaf of bread. That's outrageous. That's outrageous. Why is that happening here? Now think, this is a black rider with scales in his hands. That's the marketplace. What's going on? Yeah, war and upheaval, which causes what to the farm fields?
Shortages.
Famine. Crop destruction. There's a famine going on. That's what this is. Famine. And that comes after war, right? You know what image that I get from this is, you know, the time in Germany after World War I, where the inflation soared, the war ravaged the land. You know, I know many of us have German blood in us, me as well. And so I've heard the stories, and I remember learning from history class, and the inflation was so bad in Germany after World War I that was a contributing factor towards World War II.
Sure.
Right?
That's what's going on here. The famine is outrageous.
My parents were both from Germany, and my mother said that at, in that time period, the people, the neighbors would get together with their money, and they would put it in a barrel so someone could get something for it. They would take turns each week.
Wow.
A different neighbor would.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty severe, right?
You used to pay them twice a day because what you made at noon wasn't worth anything at night.
Really?
Yep.
Wow. So once you got paid at noon, half your day's wage, you'd go out and spend it right away. You immediately bought something. Yeah. Yeah, that's, I mean, that's unheard of in our modern day minds. I mean, I can't imagine that type of existence where the inflation is that, the economy is that wrecked and the marketplace is that bad and the crops are that poor that this kind of inflation, this kind of a famine is going on. That's what's going on here. And just a little bit further, 3 quarts of barley for a denarius. So now, why do you get 3 quarts of barley for a denarius but only a quart of wheat for a denarius?
Barley was not as valuable, I guess.
Yeah, right. Barley, along with rye and oats, were considered by the people in that era, in that time, to be lesser grains, lower quality grains. Wheat was the best grain you could have. If you had wheat bread, that was the best bread. If you had barley bread, well, that was for poor people and for the, for, you know, in times of trouble and difficulty. Barley was a lesser grain. That's all it is. So you get more of it for your denarius. So if you're willing to eat barley bread, you could have 3 loaves in a day.
Don said it makes good whiskey.
There you go. If nothing else, you could drink your lunch, right?
Feel no pain.
Feel no pain, right. All right. Now, let's see. There was something else I wanted.
Do not harm the oil and wine.
Yeah, do not harm the oil and wine. Now, why might that be? That's kind of odd, isn't it? Do not harm the oil and wine. Well, let me read for you the footnote from the Lutheran Study Bible on this verse. It's very interesting.
Holy beer.
Holy beer, yes, from the barley, right? The Lutheran Study Bible footnote for verse 6 right here, this verse that we're looking at. Wheat for a denarius. The cost given here for grain is quite high, since a denarius represented a full day's wage. Do not harm the oil and wine. The prices of these commodities are comparatively less affected by the famine. This at first seems strange, since wine and olive oil are typically more valuable than grain. Yet this depiction makes sense if one considers that wine and oil were produced throughout most of the Greco-Roman world, including Asia Minor, where John was writing, while vast areas of the empire were dependent upon imported grain.
Oh, okay.
Most of the Roman Empire had the ability to produce its own olive oil and its own wine. But apparently grain could only be grown in certain areas, whether soil conditions or climate conditions, etc. So that was part of it. So that do not harm the oil and wine. The oil and wine was a little less affected by the famine. Somebody else had last night had an NIV study Bible. And in that study Bible, which I have one as well in my office, but I didn't look at it. But they said that study Bible pointed out that oil, olive oil, and wine come from trees and vines. They have deeper roots. They more quickly grow back after the ravages of war. Well, that may be part of it too. You know, if a marauding army comes through and tramples down and destroys all of the crops and the agriculture, the olive oils and the grape vines are more likely to more quickly come back versus the grain, which has shallower roots and would be just destroyed. You'd need a season or two to replenish to get it back. I don't know. That might be part of it. That's kind of the practical reason why it says do not harm the oil and wine. However, I have an alternate explanation. And I didn't see this in any of the commentaries, which kind of, frankly, disappoints me. Also worries me a bit. Because it makes me wonder if what I'm about to tell you is heresy. I would have thought all of our great Lutheran scholars, somebody, somewhere, would have mentioned what I'm about to tell you as my interpretation of oil and wine. why it says, do not harm the oil and wine. Now, I didn't read Martin Luther, so maybe the good doctor would agree with my thoughts on this. But St. John, throughout his writings, in his gospel, in his epistles, he very often has veiled references to the sacraments. He lived in a time when persecution of Christians was ramping up. And so in order to talk about things like the Lord's Supper in the Gospel of John, he talked about, quoted Jesus as, you know, unless you eat the bread of, eat the flesh of the Son of Man, you shall not live. That's a reference to the Lord's Supper. He's talking to the woman at the well about living water. That's a reference to the baptism. He's got these kind of hidden, veiled references to the sacraments throughout his writings. You see it in his epistle lessons, too. He talks about the blood and the water testify. Well, that's baptism and the Lord's Supper. Well, in this era of church history, when someone was baptized, they would, at the same time, be anointed with oil. The Eastern Orthodox Church still does that today. It's a scented olive oil. They call it chrismation, I think. So, a baby is baptized. If you go to an Eastern Orthodox church, and I know we don't have them around here, Greek Orthodox church, I think there's some in Chicago, but they're not very prevalent in the West. We come out of the Roman church, so that's the Western church, not the Eastern church. If you go to one of those, and I know we studied this briefly in one of my classes, they'll baptize the baby, which is the baptism, and at the end, the pastor or the priest will anoint the baby with a little oil cross on their forehead. You're anointed. It's not necessary as part of baptism, but it kind of connects, because in baptism we are anointed with the Holy Spirit. We are anointed with faith. So it is kind of symbolic. I mean, we have a couple of symbolic parts of baptism, which technically aren't part of baptism. We give the candle. We give the little white cloth to represent the white robe of Christ's righteousness, right? Well, in the early church and in the Eastern Orthodox Church even today, they anoint with oil. Oil. Now, in my mind, you already know where I'm thinking. What does wine mean? The Lord's Supper. Right here, I look at this, and I see the words oil and wine, and I say, in the midst of this famine, war has come upon the earth, judgment day has begun, bloodshed and violence follows, famine follows that, and in the midst of all of this, God's church will still have the sacraments. The gospel will still be proclaimed, and the sacraments will still be administered. They will be unaffected by the calamities of judgment day and by the famine that comes about. That's my interpretation of this.
Well, some of the pastors that lived through the 30 years war, Paul Gerhardt and who's this man, Martin Rinkard, who wrote Now Thank You All Our God. I think Pastor Pugh had something in the bulletin, or has had in the past something in the bulletin.
Okay.
About that hymn. And I think that those people wrote things indicating how comforting the Lord's Supper was.
Sure. Well, the Lord's Supper is comforting all the time, even for us. We're not going through a famine.
The Lord's Supper is comforting. Still have the word
yes,
of God.
They still have the Word of God and the sacraments.
And
it's comforting them. In the midst, yeah, right, sure. All right. So don't write me up on heresy. Don't report me to the leaders. That's my interpretation there. Yeah, Bob?
My interpretation. During the extreme famine war, wheat is essential for life.
Sure.
The oil and wine, if you have it, fine. But if you have bread and water, you can live.
Right. I agree with that. Bread is more essential. You have to have bread to eat. If you don't have wine to drink or if you don't have oil, well, those are niceties or extras, but they're not essential in the family. Yeah, I agree with that. That's a little practical understanding of what's going on here. Yeah. Other thoughts? Questions? All right. We got one more horse. One more seal. He's opening the fourth seal. He opened the fourth seal. I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, come, look at John, here it is. I looked and behold, a pale horse. and its rider's name was Death. And Hades followed him. Huh. What comes after war? After the inevitable violence and bloodshed, after the famine that follows, all three of these things result in
death.
Death follows along. Now, here's an interesting little thing. This word that means pale. When you think of pale, what color do you think of?
Gray,
beige.
Smoke vapor,
okay. In my mind, I think of like a tan color. We all have slightly different versions of what it means. The Greek word here is actually chloros. Chloros. And when I looked it up in the Greek dictionary, chloros is the name of the color of the inside of a plant. Chlorophyll. If you take a flower and you pull off the outer green leaves, that inside, which is kind of a whitish-greenish color, the Greeks named that color chloros. Okay? Chlorophyll. Isn't the chlorophyll the substance in plants? Yeah?
Better to be thought an idiot than to open your mouth and prove it.
Very good, Bill. In the dictionary also, the Greeks associated the color chloros, that pale green color of the interior of a plant, they associated that color with death. Because it was said, we still think this way today too, when you're really, really sick or you're approaching death, what's the color of your skin? It's that pale, maybe a hint of greenish, kind of grayish color in there, right? That's the color of death. That's what the Greeks thought. So the word here actually is chloros. It gets translated in English as pale. But now you understand a little bit what that color means. It's that kind of palish, sickly green color, like faded green, white, you know, gray, kind of that, yeah,
like
you know,
me.
Yeah, what's that?
Like
you? No, not like you. And its rider's name is Death. How appropriate that the rider on this horse is Death, and Hades followed him. So long coming behind Death is Hades. Now, Hades is a Greek word that refers to two things, can refer to two things. It can either mean the grave, the place of burial, or it can mean the underworld, the place of condemnation, in other words, hell. And the reason, and it can mean both. It's related to the equivalent Hebrew word, which you guys have all heard before. It pops up. It's left untranslated in much of our liturgy and in the church. Sheol. You've seen that word. It comes up in the Psalms and other places. Sheol is the Hebrew word, which also means the same thing. It can mean either the grave, or it can mean the underworld, the place of condemnation. David in the Psalms in some places says, you know, about leading God's faithful into Sheol. Well, obviously they're not going into the underworld. That's just talking about going through the grave. But in other places he talks about his enemies, David's enemies, being taken to Sheol, which would be the underworld, the afterlife of place of condemnation. Hades, the same thing. It can mean either. Okay? So all four of these riders now have been released upon the earth. This is the beginning of Judgment Day. And they were given authority over how much of the earth?
A fourth.
A fourth of the earth. That's interesting. Could you say that these four kind of sort of natural phenomenon, events, condemnation events, judgment types of things, war, violence, famine, and death, do they occur today?
Yes.
Has Judgment Day already started?
Yeah.
Yeah, it has. And I think it kind of relates to this being over a fourth of the earth. This is just me thinking out loud, kind of, but kind of saying, at any given point in time, in recent history, say in the past few centuries and going forward, might we just kind of surmise in our minds that maybe a quarter of the population of the world at any given time is being subject to either war, or violence, or famine, or death? Yeah, it sort of makes sense. I mean, just think about today. I mean, we here in
Berrien County and Stevensville and St. Joe, we don't have any war thrust upon us right now. We don't have any violence upon us. We're not suffering under famine. We have a little bit of death that's floating around there, people dying prematurely and wrongly and even in a natural state of things. But you might say that's not the case throughout much of the world. You know, in places of the world where there is very severe outbreaks of war and bloodshed and famine around the world. So, yes, a quarter of the world, roughly, approximately, is suffering under these consequences already. Judgment Day has already begun. And these four horsemen, they were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword. There's the sword. That was the violence. And with famine. There's the black horse, the famine, the scales. And with pestilence and by wild beasts of the earth. Well, I think pestilence goes with famine. Famine and pestilence go together with each other. And wild beasts of the earth, I think that relates to war, the first horse. So, all these things are happening simultaneously. These four seals are open in quick succession. Boom, 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 boom. And all four of these events have begun simultaneously under the auspices of the Lamb who has opened them. Okay? So this is the beginning of Judgment Day. This is our first vision of Judgment Day. Judgment Day begins with these things, which is to say, Judgment Day has already begun. Yeah.
How would atheists fit into that?
Well, part of the reason I mentioned that Hades can mean either just the grave, especially for God's people, or it can mean the underworld for those who don't follow God. This is something that is subjected to all of us, God's children and God's enemies. We are all subject to this. This impacts all of us. And for those of us who are God's children, who believe in Him, who believe in the Lamb, who are united to Him, we were given that vision that we're going to have at the end so that we can persevere through this. Those who don't have that vision, who don't have that eternal hope or that glory waiting for them in heaven, they're in a whole different state of mind as all of this is taking place upon them. But we're all subject to it. We're all subject to it. All right. Comments or questions before we move on? Yeah, Len?
In the progression from, you know, the white horse, the black horse, the red, black, and pale, when you start with a bow, it's kind of like a battle from a distance. You're fighting catapults, your long distance type of warfare. Then you move to the sword, it's kind of hand-by-hand combat, maybe even an internal conflict as opposed to an external attack.
Sure.
And then you get to the pestilence, and that's all
famine.
It's kind of a result of all the warring activities, mm-hmm. either external or internal. And then finally you get to the end result, which would be death.
Right.
So it seems like a progression.
It's moving closer and closer to us and more severe and more severe.
Right. Then the thing that bothers me is that the second half of the last verse, where that doesn't follow sequentially to that. Is there a reason for that?
Well, I think these four horsemen are released one after another, but then they ravage the earth simultaneously. So there's initially a progression, mm-hmm. but then they're all released upon the earth. And they're going right now. So there might be...
So that's the reason for the last sentence being
yes.
in mixed order as opposed
yes.
to the same order.
It says, and they right here is a reference to these four. And they were given authority over the earth simultaneously. So now they are ravaging the earth jointly. And you're right, the order down here is mixed from the order up here. You're right. Yeah, Bob?
Did that infer that a fourth of the world, population of the world would go to hell?
No, because this is being inflicted upon Christians and non-Christians alike. We are all suffering. So no, it doesn't mean that a fourth of the world will go to hell. Because we don't know which fourth. That fourth... Somebody last night it was kind of a joke, tongue-in-cheek, said, well, maybe the fourth of the earth is a reference to the area of the earth, not the population. So maybe at a given point in time, this fourth is the Pacific Ocean. So as long as you don't go to Hawaii, you're not subject to that fourth. You know, then as that fourth kind of kind of translates around the world. You just have to stay in front of it, so you're not in that area that is devastating. Stay away from the area being tongue-in-cheek. You know, it's kind of fun. Yeah, Rich.
Have all of these events really gone on for the total time that life began?
Yeah, some of them have. All of them have.
So the end times, really, how can we say that it was now or was 50 years ago or it was when?
Mm-hmm. Well, from the very first fall of mankind,
right.
God began to bring about judgment upon sin.
So that's what.
And Cain and Abel were at war with one another.
Right.
Bloodshed resulted. There was famine. I mean, the one was the farmer, the other one was the herder, and death came about. So, in a certain sense, you're right. We can say God's judgment upon sin began after the first sin and continues to this day. That's true. There's a sense of that. You're right. Good thought. Okay. The Four Horsemen. Anybody ever hear of that? The Four Horsemen? Yeah. The Four Horsemen of Notre Dame, right? Somebody mentioned, well, there's the Four Horsemen pub down in South Bend. I guess you can drink yourself to death if you want down there.
The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, right. This is the Four Horsemen. If you hear references in culture to the Four Horsemen, this is where it comes from. It's biblical, from Revelation. It's also a very popular topic for artists. So I found some pictures. You want to look at some pictures?
Sure.
I got four pictures. Four pictures. We got to hustle through this. Sorry. This first one is a woodcut from Albrecht Dürer. He did woodcuts for Luther's Bible. This is a woodcut that would have been in Luther's Bible. There's the first horseman right there with the bow and arrow. There's the second horseman right there. You see the sword held high. There's the third horseman right here, and behind him there's the scales he's holding right there. And then here's the fourth horseman down here, and the rider on the fourth horseman, along with the horse itself, they kind of look deathly. Their ribs are showing. They're very skinny and gaunt. And he's carrying a pitchfork. And all four of these horsemen are trampling over people. And up here is the angel watching on. All of this is happening under the supervision and the allowance of the Lamb. Jesus is allowing it to happen. He's beginning judgment. Okay? So this is the picture of the four horsemen of Revelation chapter 6, back at the time of Martin Luther. Then I have another one here. It's a little more classic. It seems a little bit dark on the screen, and I apologize for that. This is done by Benjamin West in 1796. It's kind of done in that Renaissance style, that very, elegant style from that era of art. But right here, there's the white horseman with his bow and arrow. He's got a crown on his head, in case you can't see it. Right behind him is the red horse, and there's the soldier with the sword. He's got a curved sword. That's kind of interesting. Then the black horse, now this is where it's kind of dark in this area of the picture. There's the black horse right there, and there's the rider, and he's got the scales in his hand right back here. That's kind of hard to see. Sorry about that. The picture's a little bit dark on the screen. And then here's the pale horse. See, and it is kind of that grayish, greenish, pale color. There's that pale horse. And, oh, yeah, that helps. Thank you, Bob. Yeah, that helps. So there's the pale horse. And on top of the pale horse is a demon-looking creature. He's got lightning bolts in both hands, and followed behind him are these trail of demons. Well, that's kind of interesting. That's Hades following along in the train of death on the horse. And here, they're trampling over people as well, but some of the people are fighting back. Some of the people are fighting back. Here's a mother with two children, a nursing mother. There's a lion that's in there. Wild beasts are devouring. The lion is devouring. Interesting thing about this picture, right down here, there's a snake. And right next to the snake is a dead dove. What does that mean?
I don't know.
Well, the snake, sin?
Snake?
The Garden of Eden?
Yeah.
And the dove, could it be the flood?
Yeah. Last night, the initial thoughts of a couple people were, well, Satan doesn't kill the Holy Spirit. You know, the snake is Satan, the dove is the Holy Spirit. But then we kind of realize that, no, the dove is the symbol of peace. So Satan has destroyed peace. There it is, underneath, as the people are being trampled by the four horsemen. I'll leave it off for a couple more slides yet. Yeah, Mary?
Over towards the left, there's this red figure.
This? That's just a cape from this person on this plain horse who's fighting back. That's just a brown horse. They're fighting back as death is riding in, and they have a red cape behind them. Yeah, I know, it kind of looks odd. The cape is flying up in the air.
Well, it really attracts one's attention. I mean, yeah, my eyes, that was the first thing.
Right, it goes right to that. Sure. So, that's an interesting picture. It's got some symbolism in there. Okay, here's the next one, a little plainer to view. This one is painted by Victor Vaznetsov in 1887. Now, some other things to notice in here. This is interesting as well. There's the white horse. There's the king on the white horse with the bow and arrow. He's shooting. There's the red horse with the soldier, and he's got the sword. There's the black horse with the rider with the scales. And in this case, the pale horse. Now, the pale horse kind of looks like a grayish color in this case. I think that's not quite the right color for what we would think of, but, I mean, it's a grayish color. And on it is a ghost-looking figure.
Yeah.
That's how death is depicted here, a ghost-looking figure. Again, they're trampling over top of all the people down here. These are all different people down here being trampled. A couple of interesting details. What's kind of setting in the distance there?
Moon.
A blood moon. There's a blood moon. And what's looking on at the top?
The lamb and with the word.
Lamb with the book of life. Looking on. There's the lamb. And there's a little slit with blood on the lamb. It's Jesus watching on. He's opened the seals. And what's looking on the corners?
Angels.
There's the angels. All of this is happening under the supervision of God, of Jesus.
That picture is really pretty easy to figure out. I mean, more so than the other three.
Yeah, this one is pretty easy to figure out. This artist is Victor Vaznetsov in 1887. Yeah, Don?
Those columns falling, indicate like kingdoms falling.
Right.
Sure, kingdoms falling, the columns, right? Governments being toppled.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Really good.
This is your favorite one so far?
Yeah.
This will remain your favorite one.
Yeah.
The next one I have to show you. The next one is a modern one. It was done by Peter Garcia, and I don't have a date. But here's the next one.
Ooh.
Somebody said, oh, that looks like it would be a tattoo on the side of a van or something. But here we go, real quick. There's the white horse with an armored warrior with the bow and arrow. There's the red horse. The horse itself has armor. There's an armored warrior with spikes all over him. He's got a sword that's dripping in blood. There's the black horse and a very ghoulish-looking creature on there carrying the scales. And then here's the interesting thing. There's the pale horse. It's kind of got that sickly green color in here. But how is death depicted here?
The Grim Reaper.
The Grim Reaper, right. The shrouded figure carrying a sickle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the sickle doesn't come from this part of the Bible, but the sickle was a tool of harvest, right? The harvest is beginning. So, you know, the idea that the Grim Reaper carries a sickle, not really biblical, but it kind of aligns with biblical thinking. All right? So, and then, you know, this, they're just coming out of the void. This one doesn't have anything in the backgrounds like all the other pictures do. But anyway.
It looks like they're coming out of hell.
It does kind of look like they're coming out of hell, doesn't it? Yeah, coming, this flame behind them. Right. All right. Thoughts or comments or questions about the pictures? I just thought it would be something good to look at. I do kind of agree with many of you that this might be the easiest one to understand. It's got a lot of good, rich symbolism in the images. I also think this one is very pleasant to look at as well, this kind of classic Renaissance-style looking one. All right. Okay, are we ready to move on? We'll do the last part of Chapter 6 in 25 minutes. All right.
Okay.
We'll get the lights back on. Thank you, Bob. Can I have someone read this, verses 9 through 17? Go ahead, Mary.
When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the witness they had borne. They cried out with a loud voice, O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you will judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? Then they were each given a white robe and told to rest a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brothers should be complete, who were to be killed as they themselves had been. When he opened the sixth seal, I looked, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth, the full moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth as the fig tree sheds its winter fruit when shaken by a gale. The sky vanished like a scroll that is being rolled up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. Then the kings of the earth and the great ones and the generals and the rich and the powerful and everyone, slaves and free, hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains, calling to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand?
Who can stand? All right. The fifth seal is open. The first four seals, rapid succession, release upon the earth war, violence, famine, and death. And now the fifth seal is open. And what does John see? Under the altar, the souls of those who have been slain for the word of God and for the witness they had borne. Who are those?
The martyrs.
The martyrs, right. Now, in a classic sense, the martyrs, back in the early church, the Christians who were captured and persecuted and tortured and often
killed.
Fed to the lions, or used as entertainment with the gladiators, or various things like that. The martyrs. However, this isn't just those martyrs, is it? Because he references that they have to wait until the number of their fellow servants should be complete. This vision of these martyrs underneath the altar of God includes us. Includes us. All of us, in a sense, are martyrs. Here, think of it this way. What happens on an altar? On an altar in the Old Testament, what was the purpose of an altar? What did you do on the altar?
Sacrifice.
We are sacrifices to God. We are sacrifices to God. And the sin in us must be destroyed for us to be living sacrifices to God, St. Peter says, right? We're living sacrifices to God. We are sacrifices to God. Here's another interesting little tidbit. Actually, the Greek word for this altar is a very technical word that means specifically the incense altar, which was another altar in the temple. And what happened on the incense altar? They would burn incense as their prayers rise before God. Here, the witnesses up until this point, the martyrs up until this point are crying out in prayer to God. From underneath the altar, the incense altar, no less. And what is it they want? These martyrs, throughout history, God's people who have been martyred, we will be martyred as well. We will be martyred because of the sin that is within us, and we will be martyred as a sacrifice to God. So we also are martyrs in a certain sense, not in the severe sense of being fed to the lions like the early Christians, but in a spiritual sense, we too are martyrs. So we will be joining these people. And what are they crying out for? Sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? They want justice. They've been martyred, and they want justice. We want justice, too, against Satan, who martyrs all of us. We want justice. Now, we know from reading the Psalms, especially the imprecatory Psalms, those are the Psalms of crying out for justice and for righteousness upon God's enemies. We want justice too. When do we want it?
Now.
We want it now. That's right. How long, O Lord? We want justice. Avenge us. We know something though. If we read the Psalms, we read the calls, the cries for justice from King David and the other writers of the Old Testament,
they rightly recognize that ultimately justice, ultimately revenge on our behalf, does not come from our hand. It comes from God. God will avenge us. We cannot avenge ourselves. I've had various people over time as a pastor come and talk to me about some wrong that has been committed to them. Somebody outside the church, in the workplace or the community, somebody has wronged, and can I pray that God would punish them, that God would avenge me? And I say, yes. You absolutely can. King David did. And we can pray for justice. And God will bring about justice, especially upon the non-believers. And even upon the believers who may have wronged us, God may use the process of bringing about justice to change their heart. And that justice may even include earthly death for our enemies. Somebody asked last night, and this is a question maybe going through your mind, but how can God bring about death or justice for someone and still be a merciful God or a loving God? Well, God is required by His holiness and His perfection to punish sin. Now, even if someone is a Christian and goes out and commits a murder and then is sentenced with the death penalty, and then maybe it's after that point that they commit murder that they become a Christian. You know, you hear about jailhouse conversions.
Right.
And they confess, I'm sorry, they apologize, they repent of it, they know they did wrong, and yet we can say they still must suffer justice, the earthly punishment for their wrongdoing, while at the same time, God can still redeem them spiritually in eternity. So there's a difference between earthly justice and heavenly mercy, spiritual mercy. See a difference? So we absolutely can call out for justice or vengeance upon those who have wronged us. And that will include earthly justice. It may not happen before our eyes, but it will include earthly justice, and it may or may not include eternal justice. We don't know the hearts of these people, our enemies. God will condemn them if they deserve to be condemned. God will save them for eternity if they deserve to be saved through faith in Jesus. But in either case, they still can be avenged on the earth. On the earth. You see, there's some thick theology there. Rich. We can pray for justice. But we trust that it comes from God's hand, because He's the one who knows true justice. We can never inflict justice or perform justice properly. We get it wrong. Sometimes we get it wrong. Our legal system gets it wrong sometimes, right? But God will always perform justice, bring about justice properly, in the proper sense. Those who deserve it and those who don't. Okay? Yeah.
But there's a difference between praying for God's justice and praying that God will smite somebody and bring evil on them because of some injustice that they did to you.
And yeah, I suppose there is, sure.
Just saying, you know, because God knows what justice really is.
Yeah, He does, and He'll make it right. And the hardest part for us as Christians is just to let go of it and trust God. He will bring about justice.
Yeah.
We cannot. And actually, somebody last night pointed out that that's for our own good. Because if we can't let it go and we let it consume us, and I want justice against that enemy of mine who has wronged me, and I want justice, it'll just consume you mentally, intellectually, emotionally, spiritually. Rather, it's for your own good that God says, leave it up to me. I will avenge you at the right time, in the right way. I will avenge you, God says. You go on about your life. I'll take care of it. And that's the best thing that can happen to us, if we have the strength of faith to accept that and move on. That's very hard to do.
Hard to let go.
Hard to let go. We want to hold on to our grudges. Absolutely. And so what happens? God's martyrs, God's saints, call out from under the altar. We want justice. How long before you judge and avenge our blood? And what happens? They are given a white robe. What's a white robe? The righteousness of Christ given to you in
baptism.
And they are told, I think this is such a wonderful gospel. This is so wonderful. They are told to rest a little longer.
rest a little longer. I know you want justice, God says. I know you've been wronged by those on earth. Remember, you've been clothed with the robe of Christ's righteousness, and you are given rest. Oh, Jesus says, come unto me, all you who are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. I think this is a wonderful testament. This is a wonderful vision here of what happens between that time of our death and the time of Judgment Day. Judgment Day is beginning here. We're seeing Judgment Day begin. And what's happening to all God's saints, all the martyrs? Where are they? They are at rest under the altar, before the throne, clothed in a robe of Christ's righteousness. They are at rest. And they get impatient. They get anxious. God, finish Judgment Day. Venge us. Avenge us. Bring about justice. And what does God do? He says, rest a little longer. I'll take care of it. It'll come in the time and the way that I know best. Rest a little longer. Have a cookie.
Go out and play.
Have a cookie. Go out and play. That's what he says. You know, there are days in my life where I'm like, the rest. That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
I bet it would be nice and warm there. Not too warm, though.
Yeah. That'd be wonderful. Just rest there with all the saints under the altar, before the throne, with the creatures around us, the angels surrounding us. Yes, I want that rest. We want that rest. Doesn't that sound wonderful? In the midst of what's going on here, what just happened? The four horsemen are ravaging the earth. What's happening down here? We're about to see it, the calamities of the earth. And in the midst of that, God's saints are at rest because of Christ. Isn't that a wonderful gospel? That's what I would dwell on for today's lesson, that right there. I think that's tremendous. And they are resting until the number of their fellow servants and their brothers should be complete, who were to be killed as they themselves have been killed. God is waiting until when? When the full number of the saints have all been prepared. When all of those that God knows are His and will be His are all ready. All 144,000, right, exactly. We'll get to that number, symbolic number, not a real number, yes. When all the number of God's saints are ready, that's how long we have to rest. So, all right, that's the fifth seal. Sixth seal, verse 12. When he opened the sixth seal, I looked, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth. The full moon became like blood. There's that, remember in the picture, there was the blood moon in that one picture of the four horsemen? There's the blood. The moon becomes like blood. The stars of the sky fell to the earth as fig tree sheds its winter fruit when shaken by a gale. That makes me think of a fruit tree where the fruit is all ripe, maybe even overripe. And all you do is shake it a little bit and you're bombarded with apples, right? They all fall down. That's what's happening here. Judgment Day is ripe. And the skies, the heavens are shooked. And what falls from the heavens? The stars. The moon, the sun turns black, the moon turns to blood, and the stars are falling from the heavens. This is an unmaking of creation. It's a reversal of creation. And then what happens? The sky vanished like a scroll. Again, what did God create at the beginning? The heavens, the firmament?
Yeah.
And here it's being rolled up. Whether it's a night sky or a day sky, I always envision it as a night sky, but maybe it's easier to think of as a day sky. And there's the blue sky, and it's just rolled up, and there's nothing left but the void and the chaos that once was before creation. Creation is being rolled up. The sky vanished like a scroll being rolled up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. They're just crumbling and disintegrating. There's an earthquake, remember. They're just disappearing into dust. Creation is being unmade. And when that happens, the kings of the earth, the great ones, the generals, the rich and the powerful, but not just the upper class, everyone, slave and free, they hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains. Why did they hide? Just like Adam and Eve hid. Because they are afraid of God's wrath and judgment, which has now come upon them. They're afraid, and they call to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us, hide us. We don't want to be exposed to this. This is great and terrible terror. This is horrible events that are coming upon us. They hide from the face of him who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. This is where we hear of the wrath of Jesus. The only place is on Judgment Day. Jesus is the source of our forgiveness and love and blessings. But on Judgment Day, he will be filled with wrath against sin. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand? Now, I've got one more thought here. We've got some time for a few questions or comments. But somebody last night asked about, same question that you asked about, Eldon, about is this God's saints and God's people? Because the four horsemen are ravaging the earth, which includes God's saints, God's people. But now, in this time, in the fifth seal, the saints who are already in heaven are crying out for vengeance. God pats them on the head and says, rest a little longer. Until when? Until your fellow servants and their brothers have joined you. So on that day of judgment, God's people will be joining the saints under the altar before creation is unmade. Okay? So we will be saved from this final event. It's not a rapture. I'm not talking about that at all. We're just talking about the day of judgment, the event of judgment. Okay? All right. There we go. Let me check my notes. I think we about finished, and I'm almost on time. I think I got about 5 minutes or so. Oh, like 8 minutes? Time for some discussion or questions or comments. I think I covered everything from my notes. So, thoughts? Yeah, Linda.
Is that the sixth or the seventh seal?
This is the sixth. We've got the seventh seal is coming up yet. In fact, like a chapter from now. It doesn't come up immediately next. So when we start chapter 7, we don't see the seventh seal until, I think, chapter 8.
Right.
Yeah,
Don? Judgment Day, the believers that are left on the earth are caught up and rise to the Lord. That's prior to...
I think that's this event right here. You're right. St. Paul says the same thing, that the believers will be caught up on Judgment Day. I think that's right here. You're right. The believers, right as the final finale, the climax of Judgment Day is happening, the believers will be caught up to under the altar.
Now, does that mean that the unbelievers will stay on the earth then as it's being crumbled? Or?
I don't know. That's a good question. What happens to the unbelievers? Are they still here? Well, it appears that way. They're all crying out, hide us. We want to hide. We want to bury ourselves under the mountains so we don't have to witness this. Yeah, I would tend to say they are still left on the earth and suffering underneath this. Yeah. Right. Flo?
You talked about the kings of the earth and the great ones and the generals and so on.
All the rich and the powerful.
Yeah. And yet, in today's world, we don't really talk much about the kings.
Well, it would be rulers. It'd be the presidents and the prime ministers and the senators and the governors and all the rulers. I mean, that's what kings is a reference to.
Congress.
The rulers.
Congress.
Congress, yeah. Congress is caught up in this, right. Other thoughts or comments? Yeah, Eddie.
I often try and visualize what it's going to be on Judgment Day. When Jesus comes back, and it says in the Bible that everyone in the whole world will see him.
Right.
And it's just...
Yeah, that's right. I would focus you back to this little section right here on the fifth seal. You're given a white robe, the righteousness of Christ, there's Jesus, crucified and risen, and told to rest a little while longer. Yes. There will be the four horsemen ravaging the earth. They're already out here. They're already running across the globe, inflicting their problems on a fourth of the earth at a time. They're already out here. They're bothering us too. But persevere. There's that broad theme of Revelation again, right? Have patience. Persevere. Because at some point you will join your fellow martyrs, your fellow saints, resting under the altar until that final climax of Judgment Day. That rest is there waiting for you. And what comes after that rest? We already saw it in verses 4 and 5. The glory of heaven. We saw the glory of heaven. That's what's coming. So rest for a while until that glory is upon us.
That's just wonderful gospel in the midst of all this terror. As I said way back at the beginning, in the first week, the Revelation, this book of Revelation, and the whole study of end times and judgment day is a study of great comfort for us as Christians, and a study of great terror for those who are not. And it bears true right here. Okay? So have comfort.
Where are we resting?
Under the altar.
But, we won't be on the earth when the rest happens?
Right. We'll be under the altar before the throne. In heaven. In heaven. All right. Yes?
Could that mean that when we die, then we're sort of asleep in Jesus?
You know, there's that little conundrum. You're right. Somebody last night brought that up too. Because Paul describes death as sleep. And so the question is here, God's saints, God's martyrs, they're awake. They're under the altar crying out for God, impatient. They're a little impatient. Where's the vengeance? And God says, rest a little while longer. They're awake and they're aware. But yet Paul talks about death as sleep. Yeah, we talked about this last night a little bit. Yeah, good observation. So what's the difference? Well, I don't have a clear answer for that. The Bible gives us a few hints as to what happens between our individual death and Judgment Day. We don't have a real clear picture, but Paul does describe it as sleep. He also says, when I die, I am with the Lord. Jesus says to the thief on the cross, today you will be with me in paradise. What's the difference? I think the difference is, this is my explanation. Again, I hope I'm not treading on a heresy. I think the difference is that our bodies will sleep. Our souls will be awake with Jesus in heaven. And then on Judgment Day, our bodies are resurrected and reunited with our souls, we become a complete person again, and then we enter the bliss of heaven, fully and completely. It's finalized. That's my explanation. But you're right, there's a little bit of a kind of uncertainty there about exactly what. We don't quite know. All right, other comments or questions? Answered them all. All right, good. Well, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good day.
Amen.